Good, so we're carrying on a teaching series in John's Gospel entitled The True Image Revealed. We've been looking at the seven I am statements of John's Gospel. Remember, we've looked at the name of God in the Old Testament, Yahweh, literally meaning I am. And on seven separate occasions, Jesus takes this divine name, Yahweh, and uses it to describe himself. These are moments of Jesus claiming divinity. He says, I am the true vine, I am the bread of life, I am the gate, I am the resurrection and the life, I am the way, the truth and the life, I am the good shepherd, I am the light of the world. So we've been looking at these I am statements, and Jesus begins to fill in the blanks, describing what God is like. Up to this point, the Jewish people had a partial understanding of what God was like. They knew in part, but it remained mysterious, and suddenly in Jesus, they begin to understand something of the essence and nature and character of God. And then in John's Gospel, as well as seven I am statements, there's seven signs, seven miracles that John numbers these miracles as if to somehow match them up to the seven I am statements. And I would say that the seven miracles are outworkings of the identity of Jesus. He says, I'm the true vine. He says, just so you understand what that looks like, I'm going to turn water into wine to create a party atmosphere. I'm the bread of life. I provide for people's needs. Just so you know what that looks like, I'm going to feed 5,000 people. And the list goes on. So we've been matching the seven I am statements with the seven signs of John's Gospel. And John ends his Gospel account with these words, Jesus performed many other signs, in other words, more than seven, in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these seven are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Like, the point that John is making is, I don't want just to give you more information in this Gospel account. I just don't want to wow you with the stuff that Jesus did. I want you to believe. I want you to have a relationship with him, because in that relationship, you will experience life. And today we're going to look at the statement, I am the good shepherd, from John chapter 10, and then one of the miracles from John 4 as Jesus heals the official's son. Now, to understand the full weight of this expression, I am the good shepherd, like, because most of us, if I said, look, close your eyes, and just picture what that might look like. Not many of you are doing it, but just imagine the scenario. I'm guessing what comes to mind is Jesus with his white gown, sort of floating just a few inches above the ground, and he's holding a sheep, like a really beautiful sheep, just across his neck. And it's like, moment. That kind of comes to mind, but we miss the power of this statement. Jesus is the good shepherd. And I want to take on a bit of a journey so the full weight of this statement hits us like a ton of bricks. So to do that, I want to provide a theological foundation as well as a cultural foundation. And the theological foundation is really straightforward, that the Jewish people in the first century, right, they're back in their homeland. They'd been captives, slaves in Babylon. And eventually they're brought back to Jerusalem. But in the first century, at the time of Jesus, they're still not free to be the people they were created by God to be. They're being ruled over by this oppressive Roman regime. There's a heavy financial tax system sort of placed upon them to sort of financially crush them and cripple them and weaken them. They're daily being humiliated by this Roman reign. And they're crying out to God to come and rescue them. They are a people of promise. In the first century, they are people holding on to a promise. And the promise that they're holding on to is that God said that he would be their shepherd. So if you have a little look at this diagram that many of you will have seen before, this is a summary of the narrative. Creation, that's Genesis 1 and 2. Then created order begins to unravel through sin. We call that decreation. It's the pain and suffering we see all around us. And the biblical narrative is the story of God on a mission in and through Jesus. Through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, he wants to restore all things to how they were always meant to be, so that humanity are thriving, flourishing in relationship with God. Now, in terms of created order, what did God and his relationship with his people look like? And the answer is, he was a shepherd to them, number one. Think of Psalm 23, King David saying, the Lord is my... Tough crowd. The Lord is my... Boom, there we go. He leads me beside still waters. He leads me to green pastures. He restores my soul. So the Lord had always been a shepherd to his people. But when the Jewish people turned their back on God and walked away from God and eventually ended up in Babylon, and now in the first century, they're back in Jerusalem, but being ruled over by the Romans, the way they would describe their state is they would say, we are like sheep without a shepherd. Do you remember the times that Jesus weeps over Jerusalem in the Gospels? And he says he weeps because he could see that they were like sheep without a shepherd. The language Isaiah says of the human condition is we are like sheep that have gone astray, each one of us to our own way. So created order looks like Yahweh being the shepherd and his people being in close relationship. Decreation looks like being sheep without a shepherd. And yet there's this promise that God says, I'm going to come and I'm going to be your shepherd. Now, with this metaphor of shepherding, there's kind of another metaphor that's almost like interchangeable in the Old Testament. And that's God's going to be a father to his people. So back in the Garden of Eden, God is father, Adam and Eve are the kids, right? And we see a snapshot of this at the Exodus narrative, when Moses is freaking out and says to God, if I go to Pharaoh, what do I say to Pharaoh? And God says, this is what you're to say. You're to say to Pharaoh, Israel is my firstborn son, so you should let my son go. So created order is that Yahweh's dad and Israel are the son, father-son relationship, right? So what does decreation look like? Well, decreation looks like we experience this sense of being orphaned, disconnected from our father. The Jewish people in the first century, they were people holding on to a promise. And the promise was that God has said, I'm going to come and father you again. I'm going to adopt you again as my children. And in relationship, you will flourish once more. Now, I want to take you on a little bit of a journey through some prophetic texts. Some of these are quite long. So the temptation is to dial out, to drift off, to nod off. You've got soul in the city flies. There are no excuse. You take this, you wave it furiously, you stay awake, and we're going to journey through Ezekiel 34. Now you need to know, the Jewish people, they knew their scriptures inside out. I know that we live at a time that very few of us do know our scriptures inside out. But in the first century, Jewish people, they knew these prophecies because they were holding on to the promises. So they knew this prophecy, Ezekiel 34. I'm going to read it fast because there's quite a bit to go through. So the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel, this prophecy. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel. These are like the leaders, the authority figures, the religious folk, leaders of the people. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. Should you not shepherd, shepherds, take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourself with wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick or bound up the injured. You've not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You've ruled them harshly and brutally, so they were scattered because there was no shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. Side note, by the way, wild animals was like a nickname. The Jewish people believed that to be fully, fully human, you needed to be in relationship with Yahweh God. If you weren't in relationship with Yahweh God, you couldn't be fully human. So they had a nickname for the surrounding nations. They called them Gentile dogs or wild animals. And their mission was to bring Yahweh's favor to the ends of the earth so people could discover what it really means to be human. So when it says that they were scattered and became food for the wild animals, it's basically saying the surrounding nations devoured them, which is exactly what happened. The Assyrians came in and invaded Jerusalem. The Babylonians came in and finished the job and deported the Jewish folk off to slavery in Babylon. Verse 6, my sheep wandered all over the mountains on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth and no one searched or looked for them. You can see God's heart of like, you mistreated the people I gave you responsibility to care for. And then he's going to announce judgment. So listen to this. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, because my flock lacks a shepherd and so has been plundered and has become food for all the wild animals, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. And because my shepherds did not search for my flock, but cared for themselves. This is like the narcissism, the mindset of sin. Life turned in on itself. They were getting rich whilst the people were getting poorer and poorer. This is what was happening. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against the shepherds and will hold them accountable for my flock. I will remove them from tending the flock so that the shepherds can no longer feed themselves. I will rescue my flock from their mouths and it will no longer be food for them. So there's judgment, but there's one final section of Ezekiel 34 before you drift off, where God basically says, you've been neglected. Your shepherds haven't looked after you. So I'm going to take responsibility and I'm going to come as a shepherd. Listen to these words. For this is what the Sovereign Lord says. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he's with them, so will I look after my sheep. I will rescue them from all the places where they were scattered on the day of clouds and darkness. I will bring them out from the nations and gather them from the countries and bring them into their own land. I will pasture them on the mountains of Israel, in the ravines and in all the settlements of the land. I will tend them in good pasture. Can you hear Psalm 23 underneath this? The Lord is my shepherd. He leads me beside quiet waters. He leads me to green pastures. I will lead them to the mountain heights of Israel, and they will be their grazing land. They will lie down in good grazing land where they and there they will feed in a rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the Sovereign Lord. I will search for the lost, bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured, strengthen the weak, but the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice. You need to know Ezekiel 34. Because without it, you can't understand this statement, I am the good shepherd. The Jewish people in the first century were longing for God to fulfill this promise, to come to them, to liberate them, to be their shepherd, to lead them by still waters to green pastures where they could thrive. And it wasn't one of those prophecies where they were like, oh God, if that happens, you know that one about you coming to be our shepherd, if it happens, that'd be great. I mean, there's no time pressure because we're really chilled out. And you know, but if you ever get around to it, that just sounds, it sounds a lot of fun. So yeah, we're in. We're in. It's not one of those prophecies. It's a prophecy with this deep longing. They're desperate for God to come as their shepherd. You need that in the back of your mind to understand John 10. So this is the story. Yahweh was their shepherd. That's the creation story. They're experiencing decreation. They're like sheep without a shepherd, and the longing is for God to come and shepherd them once more. There's another prophecy. Jeremiah 31, I mentioned that these metaphors of God as shepherd, God as dad are like interchangeable. This is one of the texts where we see that. Jeremiah 31, God says, see, I will bring them from the land of the north and gather them from the ends of the earth. Among them will be the blind and the lame, expectant mothers and women in labor. A great throng will return. They will come with weeping. They will pray as I bring them back. I will lead them beside streams of waters. Again, echoes of Psalm 23. On a level pathway, they will not stumble. Why? Because I am Israel's father. Ephraim, which is just another term for Israel, is my firstborn son. Hear the word of the Lord, you nations. Proclaim it in distant coastlands. He who scattered Israel will gather them and will watch over his flock like a shepherd. So God's going to liberate his people. He's going to be their shepherd. He's going to be their father. He's going to lead them to life. That's the theological foundation, right? The people are longing for God to fulfill these promises. Now, there is a cultural foundation I want to talk you through. I want us to understand the waters we're swimming in as a culture. That the Jewish people were longing for a father. They were longing for a shepherd. And I want to suggest that the great cry of our generation is for a shepherd and for a dad. Paul said to the church in Corinth, you have 10,000 guardians, but you don't have many fathers. And I think Paul would say that over the city of London as he looks at all these millennials, like looks at the demographics of London. So many young people are like, wow, you've got so many guardians, authority figures. You've got teachers, you've got bosses in the workplaces, you know, you've got policemen and women, you've got so many authority figures, but oh my goodness, there's so few fathers. Because there's something about a father that makes a world of difference in the life of those that they invest in. And I just want to give you an example of the impact a father figure can have in someone's life. Now, this is a football illustration. We live in Islington, many of us. We gather as a church in Islington. The closest team is Arsenal. I'm not a fan in any way. I'm a Man U fan. I grew up in South Manchester, a place called Birmingham. So I've supported Man U for a very long time. So to lead a church in Islington near Arsenal, that creates a level of pain and tension for me. But one of the great heroes of Arsenal, one of the best players in their history, is Ian Wright, one of their top goal scorers, phenomenal player. Now, he grew up from quite a troubled background, but had an amazing teacher at school. And this teacher had a phenomenal impact on his life. And I want to show you the video.
The first real positive male in my life, and is a teacher called Mr. Pigden, and I thought that this teacher, Mr. Pigden, the words I got from the people was that he died, and I was you know what I mean, at the time I was like, oh Jesus, gutted, because he was somebody who would sit me down, he'd talk to me when you know, when I had my, he used to call it the EBGBs, because I would get angry from being like this to full on rage, and he would sit me down and he'd talk to me and he'd explain to me, you know what I mean, I, to communicate. I was like a little, like Tarzan or something. So then he took me out of the class. He literally taught me to read and write properly himself. He turned me into a monitor. So I would go around with the school register, to come collect the registers up. I would be the milk monitor guy. You know what I mean? I'd take messages to the teachers. And then once he realized I could play football and everything, he started to teach me how to play football and how you have to pass to other people and why you have to pass to other people and why you have to communicate nicely and why you have to give people encouragement. And so, like I say, when I met him in this situation, I'm at Highbury, you know what I mean, I'm doing this thing, it's all emotional stuff, and all of a sudden the teacher I thought was dead comes from behind me.
Hello, you. Long time no see.
Mr. Pigden, you're alive.
I'm alive, he says. How are you doing?
I can't believe it. Someone said you was dead.
As you see, I'm very much in, and I'm so glad you've done so well with yourself.
And I literally started to cry, like I was like, I don't know, a 5-6 year old, uncontrollable crying because of how happy I was to see him. And, you know, it's when I watched it, that is when I realized how much of an effect that man had on my life and how important it is to have a positive male figure in your life.
So Ian Wright, lucky Wright, to have such a phenomenal father figure in his life. But we need to know that hundreds of thousands of kids across the UK don't. Hundreds of thousands don't. That sociologists, and I know we hear this so regularly, that we become bored, inoculated to this reality, but sociologists refer to our generation as the fatherless generation. Thousands upon thousands of kids growing up without the influence of a dad. And I just want to sort of articulate some of like what is happening all around us so that we're not naive, we're not uninformed, that we're aware culturally of the waters we swim in. And I want to play you a track that I heard a number of years ago, just around the time where I had my first kid. So just as I was stepping into being a father, I heard this track, and I thought in many ways this track by a band called Las Vegas is essentially like the soundtrack to the fatherless generation. I want to play you the lyrics to this song. This song contains a level of anger of someone who hadn't experienced a dad for much of his life. The language gets fruity. Just want to give you a heads up. I didn't do the bit in the music, partly it would destroy the music, but more than that, I don't want to protect us from the reality of the pain that's all around us. It's in your workplace, it's in the schools that you teach at, it's in your universities, it's in our families. These are the waters we swim in. We've got to be aware of it culturally, because we have phenomenal news to speak into it. But this is the track by Las Vegas, it's called Daddy's Gone. I want to play it to you.
Hero, oh, oh, have you never healed? Oh, remember times when you put me on your shoulders? How I wish it was forever, you would hold us. Oh, oh, right now I'm too young to know how in the future it will affect me when you go. Oh, oh, you could have had it all. You, me and mom, you know, anything was possible. I
when I first heard that track, all sorts of emotions were just stirring within me. Just having become a dad, realizing that hundreds of thousands were growing up without the knowledge of a father's love in their lives. And I thought, I couldn't hear all the lyrics. I need to sort of find out the lyrics. So I went on a search engine, found the track, found the lyrics. And underneath the lyrics were just like hundreds of comments from young people just spilling out their pain. And I just got lost in like reading stories of young people just responding to this track. And I just want to read some of these comments to you. Just again, like, we've got to wake up to the pain that's in our communities. Like, this is a real issue, a defining issue of our age. So this is comment one. This song makes me very sad because my wife and I have split. And I only get to see my little girl eight a couple of days a week. I know the split is my fault and I feel like SH1T. I want to be with my daughter all the time, but I can't be in a loveless relationship. Comment two, try never even seeing your dad. To just go back and have to look at photos because you have no idea what he even looks like. Mine left me when I was 2 months old. I say F him. Why wasn't I good enough for him to keep me? This song makes me want to cry constantly. Great vocals though. Comment three, my dad died when I was 10. But he was still always my favourite person on earth before he and my mum split. I still hardly saw him, but that wasn't all his fault. Comment four, my dad left when I was 2, and he was always a part of my life, but I've realised over the years that he was only there when it suited him. I was in tears reading the lyrics, because it just made me realise that these are all the things I ever wished for. Sorry, the hay fever. This time of year is horrific. Forget your dad, he's gone. He's gone, he's gone, he's gone. The problem is you can't just forget something like that. I think the lead singer of Las Vegas will probably be a 50-year-old reminiscing what he had. You can't forget what your soul craves for, and we were created to crave for the love of a father. That is how we are wired. That is our creation story. So again, just to bring to life some of the impact culturally of this epidemic that sociologists refer to. Just going to hit you with some stats. I'm going to make no judgment. I don't want to spin these stats. I'm just going to name them. 3/4 of the households on social housing estates in the UK are headed by lone parents, usually mothers. 15% of babies currently born are without a resident biological father. Approximately 7% are born with no registered father on their birth certificate. Children who grow up without fathers present are 75% more likely to fail at school, 70% more likely to be drug addicts, 50% more likely to develop an alcohol problem, 40% more likely to have serious problems with debt, 35% more likely to experience unemployment and a need for social welfare. 70% of young offenders come from fatherless homes. And to cap it all, UNICEF's report on childhood development found that Britain is the worst country for a child to grow up in out of all the industrialized nations. It ranked 21 out of 21. Far worse than any other country in terms of poverty levels, happiness, relationships, and risk. So I've given you this theological foundation. The Jewish people in the first century were longing for God to turn up and shepherd them, to father them, lead them to life. That's the theological foundation. The cultural foundation is, I think there's a longing within each of us in this room, let alone out in the communities and workplaces we find ourselves in. There's a longing to experience father figures, a longing to experience a shepherd that would lead them to green pastures, still waters where their soul is restored. There's a longing, a yearning within. Augustine said, God, you made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. And I think we see the restlessness all around us. So, with that in the back of your mind, the theological foundation, the Jewish people are longing for God to turn up as a father and a shepherd. Have the cultural foundation in mind. People are longing for a father and a shepherd. Now listen to these words from John 10. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. Now just let the weight of it hit you. I am. It's the name of Yahweh. This is a claim to divinity. And then he fills in the blanks. What's Yahweh like? He's a really good shepherd. I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees a wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he's a hard hand and cares nothing for the sheep. The reason why Father's Day is so painful for many is their experience of fatherhood. Someone that just cared so much about themselves, just didn't care about the sheep. And we experience this in our workplaces, right? Bosses who, like, the end goal of the business is to make a lot of money. And if they have to tread over people, use and abuse people, you know, they'd often refer to it as collateral damage. Hey, this was the end target. There's always going to be some collateral damage. People are going to get burned in the process of us making money. But that's just the culture we live in. And Jesus is saying, well, that's not what I'm like. Like, I'm a good shepherd. I lay down my life. I'd rather die than trample on someone else to get ahead. Verse 14, I'm the good shepherd. I know my sheep and my sheep know me. Just as the Father knows me and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. This is phenomenally good news, right? So I want to look at how this identity plays out in action. So let's look at the sign of John 4. As Jesus begins to operate as a shepherd, remember the imagery of the shepherd is interchangeable with that of a father. We're going to see this play out in John 4. So once more, Jesus visited Cana in Galilee, where he turned water into wine. That's important, right? He's going back to the place where he performed the miracle. He turned water into wine. Now that means as he goes back, people are really excited. Like, no way, it's that rabbi guy, the one who turned water into wine. That was so cool. He's back. Let's get him to do it again. I can imagine crowds like, do it again, chant. Do it, you can imagine. It's like primary school chanting, but you can imagine something like that. Get some water, can you do it again? The crowd want to be entertained. In the middle of the crowd is a hurting father. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son who was close to death. Unless you people see signs and wonders, Jesus told him, you will never believe. In other words, like this crowd, they just want to be entertained. They want more miracles. The royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. Come down before my child dies. Now, a little bit of insight. There's a Greek word that's used for child here that's fairly rare. Doesn't appear much in the gospel narratives or in the New Testament. It's paedion, from which we get the term pediatrics. It's translated here child, but it's a far more affectionate term. It literally means like little lad, my little boy. He says, come down before my little boy dies. So I want you to somehow engage just in the emotion of the father. He's traveled a long way. He's desperate. His son is dying. His son is dying. And he's like, please come. My little boy is dying. Come and intervene. Now, I feel like I've got close to expressing something like this. Not fully there, but I've experienced something close. When my first son, Benj, was born, We went to the hospital when, you know, it all began. We were having Benj delivered at UCLH in the birthing center. Now, some of you will know nothing about this, but there's different places where you can have your kids, right? You can have a home birth. You can do it on the labor ward. The birthing center is like this kind of like uber chilled out environment where you don't have nurses running around. It's just less chaotic. You get there and everyone's like just walking down the corridors like, hey man, how's things? You know, and you don't hear any women crying. I don't think you're allowed to in the birthing center. Like, whale music is in the background. It's like, wow. Nurses are just going around, hey, another herbal tea? Do you fancy a herbal tea? Great. Fantastic. You know, keep up the good work. And very, very chilled out. Now, at this point in the birthing process, you know, pretty much pain-free. B was in agony, but pain-free for me. I was in great shape. The contractions were beginning to kick in, so B was beginning to get in a bit of pain. And then a couple of niggles, you know, took place. And the nurse said, look, you've had enough herbal tea and you're beginning to scream. And we think you're going to need actually some more help. So they took us down a level to the labor ward, which is just a bit more intense. You can hear screaming. People are running around. And the contractions kept going. And then the waters broke quite late on. And there was meconium in the waters, which basically means the baby in the womb was in distress. At that point, the nurse hits this red button in the room that we're in, and like five consultant doctors run in. And they put a sort of thing around B's tummy so it could monitor the heartbeat of Benj in the womb. And the heartbeat of a child is really fast, right? like dum 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 dum, and during the contractions, the heartbeat, and we could all hear it. I could hear it. It would start to slow down. Dum 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 dum. And then this one consultant just literally eyeballed B, and kind of with a sense of urgency said, "Look, B, this baby like has to come out. The heartbeat is slowing right down. This next contraction, the baby has to come out. I know you're exhausted and I know you're in pain." And B hadn't had an epidural or any pain support because it was too late in the process. So, but the baby has to come out. And then the next contraction begins and B's pushing and there's no breakthrough. And I'm standing by B's side feeling a level of panic and the doctors are looking stressed. And then out of nowhere, I just say, "In the name of Jesus, I command this baby to come out of the womb," like that. And the place goes really still. And these doctors look at me like, "You need to chill out. Like, there's some gas and air. If you need an epidural, whatever it takes, but you need to chill out." There was this one nurse, I could see that she was a Christian, and she just looked at me, she's like, you know, she didn't say amen, but I knew she was saying amen. The next contraction, Ben's didn't arrive, but the one after he did. Because it had been so traumatic, B was rushed off, and the first 2 hours of Ben's life, just in my arms, this moment of incredible intimacy, and I'd experienced a level of trauma. And I kind of get what this royal official must have been going through as he rushed down to Cana in Galilee. And there's a crowd wanting entertainment. And he's like, "Doesn't matter about your entertainment. Who cares about water into wine? Like, come down. You've got to meet my little boy. Help my little boy." Now try and engage in the emotion of this father. "Go," Jesus replied, "your son will live." And listen to the next verse. This is just phenomenal. "The man took Jesus at his word and departed." That's what you call faith, right? Basically, okay, Jesus, if you say it, you're the one, you just said you're I am. You know, you've claimed to be God, God who spoke the world and it came to being. He said, "Let there be light," and there's light. If you're saying my son's going to live, fine, I'm going to take you at your word and departs. How incredible is that faith? While he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, "Yesterday at 1 p.m, the fever left him." Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said, "Your son will live." So he and the whole household believed. This was the second sign Jesus performed after coming from Judah to Galilee. Like this amazing moment. I think this story is a story about two fathers, right? The first father is the royal official who just comes to Jesus. "You've got to come down before my little lad dies." A father traveling a long distance, doing whatever it takes for his son to experience life, not death. Fullness of life. It's the first father. The second father in the story, the second shepherd, if you like, in the story, is God. In human flesh, in the person of Jesus. He's doing what all the shepherds weren't doing in Ezekiel 34, right? He's strengthening the weak. He's binding up the brokenhearted. He's searching for the lost. He's healing the sick. He's being a really good shepherd. He's being a really good dad. And this is Father's Day, right? I just want to give you a snapshot into the heart of God. He's a really good shepherd. He's a really good dad. And when Jesus tried to articulate the phenomenal love of his father, he told the story of the prodigal son. I don't have time to tell you. I'd love to tell you. Don't have time. But it's a story of a father humiliating himself to run and welcome home his lost son, doing whatever it takes. And the story prophetically points to the cross, that God's about to humiliate himself, being stripped naked, hung on a cross, doing whatever it takes so that sins can be forgiven, shame washed away, so that we could experience fullness of life. And I want to land by just giving you maybe a modern retelling of the prodigal son's story. I want you to imagine that you've had a really rough season in your life and then something happens, it's the straw to break the camel's back. A tragedy in the family, redundancy, you lose your dream job, a relationship falls apart, I don't know. Something happens and you can't process the disappointment and you head out one night and you have like way too many drinks. You're just trying to sort of like distract yourself from the pain. And you've had so many drinks that you end up going home with a guy or a girl that you've never met before. And you end up doing things that you're deeply traumatized that you did. And then you wake up in the middle of the night in this house you've never been in a bed you've never been in with a guy or a girl that you've never seen before, and there's vomit all over you, and you're like, what am I doing here? You come to your senses and you're like, I've just got to get out of this place, I've got to get home. So you leave that place. It's in the early hours of the morning, you're traipsing across London, you're shrouded in shame, and you get home and you're finding your keys, and you realise you haven't even got your keys, you must have left them somewhere, and you're going to have to ring on the doorbell, and you're going to have to wake up one of your flatmates or housemates, and they're going to see you with vomit everywhere, with a massive hangover, and it's really early in the morning, but you ring on the doorbell anyway, and the door opens and it's Jesus. And what does Jesus do? How you answer that question says everything about your understanding of the nature of God. What does Jesus do in that moment? My friend gave this illustration, and he said, if you read the gospel narratives, like the scandalous grace of God, you'd have to conclude that what Jesus would do is he'd hug you, despite the vomit, he'd embrace you. And he'd take you inside, and he'd make you a coffee. He'd make you breakfast. That's what he did to Peter after Peter screwed up. Just made him breakfast. He'd make you breakfast. He'd give you a bit of time and space to clean up, to be fully compos mentis. And then eventually he'd sit you down and with eyes of pure grace would say, where does it hurt most? Because I'm here with power to heal. Where does it hurt most? I'm here with power to heal. Now, if you think Jesus shouldn't respond like that, you're right. He shouldn't. If you think Jesus wouldn't respond like that, you're wrong. He would. If you think he shouldn't, you're right. Like, we don't deserve that level of grace. Surely you'd expect some rebuke, some discipline, some form of correction and all of that. And yes, that would eventually come. But mercy triumphs over judgment, right? So if you think Jesus shouldn't respond in that way, you're right. Grace is scandalous. It's a disgrace in the eyes of the world. But if you think he wouldn't respond like that, you're wrong. He would. And when Jesus tries to describe to this people yearning for a shepherd, yearning for a father, as we try and articulate to a culture yearning for a shepherd, yearning for a father what God is like, our answer has to be, he's full of grace. He's a phenomenal shepherd. He's a phenomenal father. He will do whatever it takes to lead his kids to life. He will humiliate himself. He'll die a brutal death. He'll rise to new life, so that his people can follow that journey from death to life. This is what our God is like. If you're here and you don't know Jesus, I just want to say that this is phenomenally good news. It's a free invitation. And God would say, I'd love to be your shepherd. I'd love to be your father. If you're here as a Christian, this is too good not to share. I've said culturally, the waters we're swimming in, the deep yearning is for a father, for a shepherd. This is too good not to share.